asked in particular who was the author of this idea. So if you recall, oh, you can't see that? You need new glasses. Okay. Okay. So in estimating the trace of a function f of a, then as I pointed out, that one way, of course, is just having the vectors EI, but another way was to use a Monte Carlo technique. And as I mentioned, I had a senior lapse, as I say, and I couldn't remember who was responsible for the theorem. It's a man called Hutchinson. And this is actually a very specialized version of his theorem. And it says that you construct a vector z with plus ones and minus ones with equal probability. And then the expected value of z transpose hz is just a trace of h. And here's what the variance is. So then I said, well, of course, you can use the classical Monte Carlo idea and get upper and lower bounds because we can get upper and lower bounds on these quantities. And for the generalized cross-validation, we set m equal to 1. And I talked earlier today to David Andrews, who's a statistician. He said, oh, yeah, that's a good way of generating random numbers using cross-validation. Nevertheless, there are many people who do use such a technique. And I guess, what do they call that? Garbage in, garbage out, you know, sort of. I was also asked about computing other eigenvalues for other problems. And I won't go into this deeply, but this is a problem that Bai and I worked on. And that's the following. You have the generalized eigenvalue problem, hx equals lambda sx. And you want the sum of all the eigenvalues which are less than or equal to mu. And again, using a Monte Carlo technique and our stuff on quadratic forms, we were able to make very good estimations of this quantity toss of mu. But I won't go through the details here. Well, I want to go on to now what I started last time, and that's what I called modified moments. So let me just discuss that again, back up and give the basis for this. So can we have the lights on again? So modified moments, it's interesting. It really came about in the early 70s, and several people had similar ideas at the same time. So moments are defined as the integral of lambda kdw of lambda. And so these are the classical moments that one studies. But modified moments are, you have some quantity mu k and the integral of pi k dw of lambda. Pi k is a polynomial, and it doesn't have to be, but we'll think of this polynomial as satisfying a three-term recurrence relationship. Pi k plus 1 of lambda is equal to lambda minus ak plus 1, pi k minus bk squared, pi k minus 1. So this relationship is known, and this is the relationship that we're trying to determine. That is, we're trying to find a set of orthogonal polynomials with respect to w of lambda. So this is what we'd like. Pk plus 1 is equal to lambda minus ck plus 1 pk minus eta k squared pk minus 1 of lambda. Okay. And the question is, can we find an algorithm for performing these calculations? And there were several reasons for wanting to do this, and I'll point out some of them in just a little while. So I'll define the Gramian, GRS, as the integral of pi r lambda, pi s lambda, dw of lambda. And of course, that would be 0 if these were really orthogonal with respect to that measure. And then very often, there are situations where the polynomials pi are orthogonal with some measure, respect to some measure nearby, and so you're changing the measure and you'd like to know how things go. Now, if you recall, one thing I talked about was also the Hankel matrix, which is really a Gramian 2. And then we looked at the Kolesky decomposition. And what I pointed out is that by knowing the Kolesky decomposition, then from just these elements, these diagonal elements and these super diagonal elements, then one could determine these coefficients here. Now, if we write G, the Gramian here, as R bar transpose R bar, then and if R bar is again an upper triangular matrix, then lo and behold, then from these diagonal and super diagonal elements of the upper triangular matrix, then one can determine the recurrence coefficients. We'll say more about that in just a little while. Now, one reason that Cauchy was interested in using different bases is because often this matrix H would be very ill-conditioned. So let me just point out a use of a very nice set of bases, and that's the Chebyshev polynomials. And if you recall, the Chebyshev polynomials have a nice recurrence relationship, ck plus 1 of lambda is 2 lambda ck lambda minus ck minus 1 of lambda. Okay, so these are the wonderful Chebyshev polynomials. And then you all may remember from high school that, what is it, cosine. These are cosines, of course. R plus S theta is cosine R theta cosine S theta minus sine R theta sine S theta. And then cosine, well, we'll make it absolute value, R minus S theta is equal to the same R theta cosine S theta minus, plus, sine R theta, sine S theta. So we have the relationship that C R of theta, C or C S theta, that product is equal to C R plus S theta plus C R minus S theta all times a half. Okay, and therefore, if we choose as our basis for the Gramian, in other words, GRS, as the integral of, let's say, CR, well, I'll call it lambda now, CS lambda, dW of lambda, then that's going to be just a half, well, you can see, of CR plus S, the integral. CR plus S of lambda dW of lambda minus the integral CR minus S lambda dW of lambda. I guess that's a plus, sorry. And so the Gramian consists of two matrices. One, depending upon the sum of the indices, so I'll write this as, it depends on the sum of the indices. So you get a Hankel matrix here, right? And then this matrix, where it depends upon the difference, this is a Toeplitz matrix. Okay? So this is a nice idea. If you use, you have some weight function, and if you can compute these quantities, these modified moments with respect to the Chebyshev polynomials, then you have the sum of the Hankel plus Toeplitz matrix as your Gramian. And that means, of course, there's a fast way of factoring such matrices, just like there's a fast Hankel solver, there's a fast Toeplitz solver, there's a fast Hankel plus Toeplitz solver. And the name Hoenig is the name that comes up most often in that connection. So one could actually construct in O of n squared operations these coefficients. You can write that as R bar times transpose times R bar, and one could calculate the coefficients very quickly. Well, we'll make another use of that in just a moment. Okay, so here's an application I really like, and it was in the same vein, and it comes about in data analysis. And it's interesting, I did have those notes. Here we go. So one of the things that people have been very interested in numerical computation is often updating and downdating. You have a matrix, you add a matrix of rank one, then solve the new system of equations or compute the new set of eigenvalues and so forth. So suppose we have a set of data, I'll write it as y sub n, super n, and we have n coordinates, xi, and maybe some weights, I equals 1 to n. And then we add one more piece of data. So still xi, wi, n. Okay. And now associated with this is a set of recurrence relationships, right? So we have some ci's and eta's. And now, and they have a super n on them. So we have a set of orthogonal polynomials defined by these coefficients. And now what we want is the new set of coefficients for the orthogonal polynomials with respect to this measure. So with respect to a new measure, because now we have n plus 1 points instead of n points. All right. And so we have a set of polynomials, p, k, super n of lambda, okay, n over k. And now the question is, how can we construct the new set of orthogonal polynomials with respect to these n plus points and, one more weight point? And the idea is to use the modified moments. So if you look at the Gramian, what we call Gramian, that's just the integral of PR super N, PS super N, dW of lambda. And I'll put an N plus 1 here. Okay. So I have a new measure dependent upon these n plus 1 points. But I'm using, for my Gramian, the old set of polynomials. Okay. And so this is just equal to the sum, I equals 1 up to n plus 1, p sub r n, that p s super n, times w I. Okay. But what's true here? Well, let's assume R is not equal to S for these orthogonal polynomials. Well, that means the first N terms are just going to drop out. So this is going to be equal to 0 plus P R super N XI plus 1 P S XI plus 1 super N times WN plus 1. Oh, this should be n plus 1, n plus 1. In other words, if I want to get this Gramian matrix, all I have to do is evaluate the old set of polynomials on the new point, the additional point, okay? And then we get this thing here. So G, this matrix G, looks like the identity plus a matrix of rank 1. Okay. So you can ease it because of this very simple construction here. Okay. And therefore, let's see, well, what about this quantity here, the Kolesky decomposition? What can we say about that? Well, earlier today, did you have a, okay. So I thought, where is my colleague from earlier today? Who spoke earlier? Oh, they are. So that's a, R would, is called a semi-simple matrix. So you can construct this in a very O of n squared operations. Okay. Well, this would be capital squared. O of n squared operations, you can construct a new set of orthogonal polynomials. Okay. Well, or maybe even, yeah, I think that's correct. So this turns out to be a very useful device. So you can add data. For instance, you can add your points sequentially. Or you can drop data. You can also simultaneously drop data. So if we, after all, if we wanted to drop a point, then we can do something quite similar. So adding and dropping data. So the, in the classical way one handles orthogonal polynomial, you have some interval, and first you, you know, you fit a linear fit, and then you get a quadratic fit, and so forth. And what I'm saying now, using this kind of formula, you can sort of have a wave, and you can read and take your data one point at a time and build up your polynomials. You don't need to know all your data at the same time in order to fit your data with orthogonal polynomials. So it's a very useful technique. And I think this yes. Uh-huh. So you, all you need to know is this, the diagonal and the superdiagonal of this matrix. But because the Gramian has this very special form, the diagonal matrix plus matrix of rank 1, you're really in good shape. All right. Well, I want to do just a couple more things with modified moments that are interest to me. And one is the following. Suppose you said, say you have a set of polynomials on some interval I, and then another set of orthogonal polynomials with respect to, it could even be a different measure, on another interval j, and then you would like to combine them, these two set orthogonal polynomials. So here you have some set of, here's some interval, you have a set of orthogonal polynomials here, you have a set of orthogonal polynomials here, and then you want to combine the two orthogonal polynomials with a weight function equal to w of lambda, w bar lambda on the two intervals. Then by just using these ideas of modified moments, you can combine them, devise recurrence relationships, and get the new set of orthogonal polynomials. So sometimes in numerical processes, we have a set of Chebyshev polynomials on one interval and a set of Chebyshev polynomials on another interval, and then we want to combine the Chebyshev polynomials. That doesn't make them optimal on those two intervals, but we can combine them in such a way that we would get a good approximation to zero on the two intervals. And that's often useful in certain iterative methods. And speaking of iterative methods, I'm going to hark back to a method that's a favorite method of mine. It's called the Chebyshev method. And so let me, I like it especially since I wrote my thesis on this method. And I continue to work on it in one way or the other. So let me just review some of the ideas here. So you're solving a system of equations AX equals B. And we're going to think of an iterative method. And the iterative method is going to look like XK plus 1 is equal to, well, I minus alpha A XK plus B. And A is some symmetric, oh, plus alpha B. alpha is some parameter, which we'll say a bit more in a moment. And A, we're always assuming A is symmetric and positive definite. Right? So this is just equal to B times xk plus, I'll call this vector C. Okay. So if we look at the difference between the true solution and the approximate solution, that's just B times xk minus x. And so this says that the error, E sub k, that's this difference here, is just B raised to the kth power times E naught. Okay? So each time we do an iteration, we decrease, well, we multiply the error by B. And we want the eigenvalues of B to be less than 1. So that implies that alpha should be between 0 and 2 over, B, where the eigenvalues of A are between A and B. Okay? So that's a well-known result. And there's even, it's known that the optimal choice of alpha is 2 over A plus B. That will minimize the spectral radius of this operator. So this method has been known, this is called the Jacobi method, and it can converge quite slowly. So what one does is have a new sequence. Yk is the sum, akl xl xk, k equals 0, or l equals 0 to k, and the sum akl is equal to 1. All right, that turns out to be important. So we're going to average these iterates as we go along. And what you can see is easily enough that the difference between yk minus x is just the sum akl. And then you see we're having these sums of errors here because akl equals 1. So this would be b to the l power times e0. And that's just some polynomial in degree k times b times e0. Okay? So for our new process, the error in the new process is some polynomial operating on e0. And then the classical argument is, the following. We look at the norm, yk minus x, that's less than or equal to the norm of tkb times the norm of e0. And what we want to do is to make that as small as possible. The norm we always talk about, by the way, is the 2 norm. So I'll look at B as a symmetric matrix. Is Q lambda of, I'll just put the alpha here, stressing that the eigenvalues of B are a function of alpha times Q transpose. Okay. And then the argument says, okay, well, we want to minimize the maximum value of pk of lambda, okay, for, well, lambda between A and B, because that's the best we probably have, and pk of 0, of 1, equals 1, this normalization. And that comes about, again, because of this quantity, this normalization here. Because we insist that the sum of the coefficients are equal to 1, that's the same thing as saying this polynomial at 1 must be equal to 1. Right. So the answer is given in terms of the Chebyshev polynomials. And basically, I'll write it as pk. So lowercase, I'm thinking in terms of a scalar, but it's the same polynomial as this. Pk of lambda half is the Chebyshev polynomial. I on the interval AB. So that's important. We have to normalize this matrix, this polynomial, to be on the interval AB and to be as small as possible on that interval and to take down this value PK of 1 is equal to 1. Okay, that's important. Now, I wrote down earlier how the Chebyshev polynomial set is, if they're just normalized to the interval minus 1 plus 1, looks like that. But now, of course, it's normalized to this interval AB, and it's important to be able to calculate AB. So most times you can get a guesstimate of B, but knowing the smallest eigenvalue is very difficult, little a. We're eventually led, you see, this would seem to imply that we have to save all these vectors, x sub l, during our calculation. But the Chebyshev polynomial satisfying these nice recurrence relationship means we can rederive a new algorithm in terms of the y's, and we get an algorithm yk plus 1 is equal to yk minus 1 plus omega k plus 1 times b yk plus yk plus c minus yk minus 1. Okay, so you can see it's nice three-term recurrence relationship. The whole everything, though, is hidden by this quantity omega k plus 1, and omega k plus 1 is a function, and I won't write it down, of A and B. So you need to know those values, and the better you know those values, the better off you are. Okay. Now, for a long time, it was a big question, could you perform this iteration, guess at an A and B, and then improve upon the parameters, re-guess the parameters? And it was very difficult to know exactly how to do that. There were lots of suggestions. Well, in the meantime, the world has moved on, and the Chebyshev method is not so much of interest. So maybe I have to confess something. I mean, that is, here's the Chebyshev method. The conjugate gradient method, which is the method, seems to be the method of choice so often, can actually be expressed in a similar to this. And these omegas are come about from the data itself. And so the Chebyshev method and Richardson, the successful relaxation, seem to have dropped out of the picture. But because I've been dedicated to working, I don't know, I've worked on solving a problem that maybe people aren't interested in. At any rate, I will now give you the solution to this problem. That, yeah? Okay. Well, and also in parallel computation, it could be a quite good use. So let me just sort of outline, again, using these ideas of moments, again, how one might solve this problem. And it's the following. So we have this relationship, and from this, we derive a new relationship for the residual vector. So the residuals are something that can be easily calculated. Only I have the minus here, and it looks like this. For this particular operator, alpha A times RK plus RK minus 1. Okay, so we have this nice three-term recurrence relationship for the residuals. And what we see is that the kth residual vector is a polynomial in our matrix I minus alpha A times the initial residual vector. So this is the Chebyshev polynomial we have here. So this PK here satisfies the three-term recurrence relationship. All right. Now, if I look at the inner product of RK and, let's see, R0. Okay. That's just equal to the inner product of P K hat of lambda times, well, P naught hat of lambda, that's just a constant, times some measure dw of lambda. And that's just equal to, well, something, if we, this, since this is a constant throughout the interval, this is just equal to a quantity mu sub k. It's equal to a moment, or directly proportional to a moment. So if you took the kth residual vector, took the inner product with R naught, you would get the kth moment connected with this distribution. So the Chebyshev polynomials are orthogonal, but they're orthogonal with respect to some other measure. And we don't know what that measure is. This measure here, dw of lambda, that's defined really by this initial vector here. That's what really brings that into play. Okay, so this would be one way to go. You compute all these quantities. Well, I called it mu k. It's really a nu k in my notation. And you really need nu 0 up to something like nu 2k before you can determine c 1 up to ck. Eta 1 up to squared up to eta k minus 1 squared. So in other words, from this, it looks like you need 2k plus 1 moments, right, in order to determine this k by k matrix, which would mean that you've had to do 2k iterations. You have to go through too many iterations. And can you somehow avoid some of that? Well, Chebyshev polynomials are wonderful, and they satisfy the property. If you cosine of 2 theta is equal to what? 2 cosine squared minus 1. Right. So the Chebyshev polynomials are one of the few polynomials, I think are the only polynomials, that if you square the kth Chebyshev polynomial, the kth orthogonal polynomial, you essentially get the 2kth polynomial. There's this correction factor, minus 1 here. So, in fact, I think there's a theorem to that effect. Of all orthogonal polynomials, it's only the Chebyshev polynomials that have the property that when you square a kth orthogonal polynomial, you get a 2kth polynomial, essentially. Okay. And what that means then, if we take RK, the inner product of RK with RK, then that's just going to be equal to, that would be this thing here, so that's the integral twice, and then we would have, I want to take twice RK, RK minus, well, this is just R0, and this is essentially going to give us, from this relationship here, nu 2K. There's some factor and fudge factor in front of all this, but essentially what I'm trying to show is that you can get the 2Kth moment by looking at the inner product of the Kth residual with itself, and make a little correction, and that gives you the new 2k moment. And the 2k plus first moment, you can get in a similar way. So after k iterations of the Chebyshev algorithm, using these wonderful recurrence relationships, you can get the modified moments. From those modified moments, you can construct a tridiagonal matrix. From that tridiagonal matrix, you can get estimate of the extreme eigenvalues. It's akin to the Lanczos process. And then you can improve the algorithm. So this is an algorithm very different in philosophy than the conjugate gradient method, but still it enables one to dynamically choose parameters in a relatively simple way and sort of get more or less the same ultimate rate of convergence as the conjugate gradient method. Yeah.
The estimates you get with
Yeah, yeah. You get a whole bunch of estimates of eigen. You know, you get the others.
Right. But they're all within the extreme.
Yes.
But really, you're trying to get outer estimates.
Yeah, and so you have to use a five. But this is much better than anything else you could do. Now, so you would like to get a lower bound for the smallest eigenvalue and upper bound. I don't know how to do that. But these estimates converge relatively fast, and they're good enough. So I've taken situations where I take an A and B that are completely outside the interval, begin the the Chebyshev method, and get enough information then to get good estimates of the eigenvalue. So the initial estimates don't seem to play an important role. It's the Lanczos. Yeah, because this J that you're constructing is really the same tridiagonal matrix that you would get out of the Lanczos algorithm. Okay. Well, just as I said, it solves a problem I think that people have been long ago were interested in. I'm not so sure they are. But this is another message I like to always say to my people here, is that you don't know in numerical analysis. Methods come and go. A method of the 50s may be the method of the 2010 or something like that. Yeah. Like the Lanczos. Well, I'm hot. So the next thing I'm going to really switch to styles now and use mainly transparency. And talk about some joint work with Jim Vera and Payne and Millenfire. And it was. Hope people don't mind my giving little philosophical statements from time to time, especially if there are students in the audience. I went to a lecture because it had the word moments in the title, and it was. And I couldn't even stay till the end, but I got in touch with the person who gave it. And so you sometimes go to lectures that are not completely relevant to your own work, but sometimes they turn out to be really useful to follow. And because there's a school of thought around Stanford, I should say, you only go to lectures that are immediately of concern to your own interests, research interests. And so this work is joint work with Jim Vera and Payman Millenfire, and it's shape reconstruction from moments and scattered data. And can we have the lights just on? One more moment. Well, one more. Okay. So here's some shape. Here's some domain. It's made up of, it's an n-gon in the complex plane. We can compute by some device the moments associated with this n-gon. And if we know a priori in this initial study how many extreme points we have here. So we have, we want to, from a finite set of moments. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. From 10 moments, can we reconstruct this polygon? Okay, so it's a complex domain, and there are, most things go through, but there are a few changes. Thanks. And there are lots of applications, or alleged applications of what I'm about to talk about, and you're not leaving us, are you, Esmond? Or you're just okay. All right. So the question is, how do we, given the set of moments defined on this domain, how can we reconstruct the domain? And everything seems to, the way we do things depends upon. Originally a formula given by Schoenberg. Schoenberg was a approximation theory fellow, and Motzkin at was at Wisconsin, and Motzkin was at UCLA, and they hit upon this formula. It's alleged over a cup of coffee or lunch, and it's a very simple relationship. So here it says, you can evaluate the double integral over a triangle of the second derivative of z by evaluating the function at 3 points, z1, z2, and z3, and with a set of weights here. Okay? So T is a triangle in the complex plane with area A. F of z is analytic in T, in over the T. And so just notice we have the right-hand side is the second divided difference of F at the vertices of T. Yes, you do. In this case, you would know the z1, z2, z3. This is just a formula that says, given a triangle, the corners, yeah. These are the vertices. T is a triangle, yeah. And let's see, the right-hand side is the second divided difference of F at the vertices of T. So it's like an interpolation formula. So to integrate the second derivative, okay, over T, you just need to evaluate F at 3 points. Okay. So that turns out to be useful. And then this was later generalized for any simply connected n-gon. And so what it says then, if you want to integrate over any simply connected n-gon, the second derivative of z, then you weight this by some aj's and f at the extreme points, f of zj. Mm-hmm. And this is a formula for the aj's and so forth. And you'll notice it's e to the I phij here, and the phij's are defined here. All right, and so that's the key. That'll turn out to be the key. So let's take f of z. We can take anything we want. We'll take it z to the k. So we'll substitute, well, the second derivative is now z to the k minus 2. And here's, it's a quadrature rule that we essentially have here. Okay, so tall k's, these are what we're essentially, we can compute. And what we're really trying to find out are the aj's and the zj's. The zj's will be the extreme points that we're looking to find. The vertice of any simply connected n-gon can be reconstructed from the tall k's for k equals 0 up to 2n minus 1. And, well, I'm going to describe the algorithm for doing this. Well, look, this looks like, I think I pointed this out before, this looks like the solution to a difference equation. After all, if somebody said they had a set of quantities like that, you would say, well, that's the solution to a 2nth difference equation of order n. So if you have these tall k's here, then you should be able to reconstruct the difference equation. From the difference equation, you can construct the characteristic equation. From the characteristic equation, you can get the zeros and then get the weights. And that's precisely what we outline here. So here's the characteristic polynomial, and you can solve for the characteristic polynomial. Here's a Hankel matrix that we have here, and I guess in the statistical literature, this is called the Ewell-Walker equations, and they can be solved by a very simple algorithm. Well, it looks like a Hankel matrix again, right? So tall 0, tall 1, tall. So it's constant along the along the diagonals. So I can, okay. So this matrix I call H naught, this Hankel matrix here. And if I use that expression, this the Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Then you really see that H naught is given by V, a van der Moen of this sort, times the coefficients of the characteristic polynomial, weights, times V transpose. Okay, and this is called, as I called it earlier, Prony's method. It's a well-known method. It's frequently rediscovered by engineers. And from a numerical point of view, it's a very unsatisfactory method to use. So we generally discourage people from using Prony's method. There are examples in Lanchos's book on applied analysis where you try to avoid this at all costs. Okay, but here's the basic gimmick. So here's H naught. That's the Hankel matrix. And H1 is what you get when you displace the first column of the Hankel matrix. You'll see you have V, the van der Moen, times D, times Z, times V transpose. So what we say, H naught and H1 are simultaneously diagonalized by V1, inverse, and therefore the vertices are given by solving this generalized eigenvalue problem. That's the key. So we construct H0, which is made up of these moments, tau 0, et cetera, and then H1 begins with tau 1 in the 1-1 corner, and we need to solve for the eigenvalues of this problem. And so one of the very effective tools for computing eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the problem Ax equals lambda Bx is known as the QZ algorithm. And that algorithm is originally due to Clive Moeller and Pete Stewart. And the idea is to, given two matrices A and B, construct two orthogonal matrices so that one matrix is brought into an upper Hessenberg form and the other matrix is made into upper triangular form. And in the QZ algorithm, both matrices are then eventually brought into upper triangular form, and from that upper triangular form, you can compute the eigenvalues. Now, the first part of the QZ algorithm is dedicated to taking the matrix, say, H1, and making it into an upper triangular matrix, upper Hessenberg matrix, excuse me, and making H0 into an upper triangular matrix. So that's all. In fact, there's a lot of what we call zero change chasing in the numerical analysis community. So here you have, maybe I should look at that. Here we have two matrices, A and B. We want to solve Ax equals lambda Bx. And then the idea is the first part of the algorithm is to make this triangular and to make this upper Hessenberg. Upper Hessenberg is just contains the elements immediately below the diagonal. And then by a series of orthogonal transformations, these elements here are all iterated until they're zero, so that you're led to, after numerous transformations, to two triangular systems in the real case. And then these eigenvalues here are just the ratios here. Okay, but one of the longest parts of the calculation is to get the matrices into this form of A and B, this being upper Hessenberg and this B. Do you know what percentage of the calculation that is? It's a pretty high percentage. I mean, yeah. But my colleague Jim Vera recognized the following. If you have the matrix H bar, which is now N by N plus 1, and you see it's a rectangular matrix, and if you use an orthogonal transformation and make this into an upper triangular matrix, well, it's going to be upper triangular with one more column over here. And that immediately leads to, so with one sweep through the matrix, this becomes upper Hessenberg, and this becomes upper triangular. And now I'm part 2.5 on my lecture. I explained to many earlier there are 3 parts to these lectures. The second part is where a few of the specialists understand it. And the third part is when only I understand what I'm talking about, because otherwise you wouldn't take me seriously. And somewhere I'm between 2 and 3 at this point. Have I confused you yet? Okay. Okay. Now, furthermore, because of this very special nature of the matrix, there's what's called a fast QR algorithms. These are methods devised by Richard Brent and others, and can be done in a very stable way so that this matrix can be made into an upper triangular matrix, and this matrix H becomes upper Hessenberg. So when I, of course, you could think of doing the following, looking at H0 inverse H1. That just gives you back Prony's method, essentially. You don't want to do that. So in solving generalized eigenvalue problems, it's an article of faith. You don't want to compute B inverse A, but you rather want to work on the two matrices independently of one another. Okay. Well, there's a lot more, and much of this material has now been published in CISC, yeah. And there are various ways of finding the weights. Let me just point out a couple things. One is the vertices are not uniquely determined. Are uniquely determined for the moment, but the interior, but is the interior necessarily so? And so here's a little problem in geometry. These lectures are in honor of Professor Toxeter. So here we've determined these 3 extreme points, 1, 2, and 3. But you can see this has the same set of extreme points, and this has the same set of extreme points. So the question is, do the extreme points determine the shape of the domain? And it's not completely true. There are certain conditions. If the domain is convex, then it is uniquely determined. Otherwise, it's not uniquely determined. So I will give a little example. There's some simple perturbation theory that I have written down here. So H0 and H1 are the two matrices that I've been working with. We need to look at its eigenvectors and its eigenvalues. And then if we do a little first-order perturbation theory, we find out some information about the coefficients in the perturbation. And this quantity here is of some significance, and we can actually calculate it under certain assumptions. So if you make the assumption that the norm of G and the norm of H, those are the terms you have in the perturbation, are of equal magnitude, then you get an expression like this. These are all quantities you can essentially evaluate. And if this guy here, so this is an eigenvector, this vector mu j here, H naught is a Hankel matrix. And if this quantity here is small, then we say that the problem is ill-disposed. And this So this tells us how reliable, in some sense, how robust the coefficients are. So here's a domain. Okay, so here you can see we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 points. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There are 2 points that are concentrated. This is 2 plus 10 to the minus 3 times I, and 2 minus 10 to the minus 3 times I. So here's the accuracy with which we found the nodes. Here's the accuracy with which we found the weights. And then these are the S's. And you can see when the S's get large, then the coefficients are not nearly as well determined. For instance, when S equals of the order of 10 to the 7th, then the A's are only good to 10 to the minus 6. All right. And these are, you'll notice that these are the points near this coalescence. And in another numerical experiment, we reconstruct the letter E. E stands for end, so I guess that's where we are. This is another example of sort of given the moments over a domain such as I have here, and we can say something about the accuracy with which these S's give us a measure of the accuracy. Okay, well, this is a very interesting problem, and I think it has some good applications. Of course, we've only discussed the n-gon here. The more interesting domain would be one that's made up of algebraic curves or made up in some other ways, and we're currently working on problems of that nature. But it doesn't have all this beautiful algebraic structure that we have when we're studying moments. So moments are matrices and moments and quadrature, old ideas from numerical analysis. It's useful to put them together and look at them and see what they can yield. There are always more interesting applications coming along the line. And as for me, I always see these problems. You know, once you have a tool, then you give a man a hammer and he finds how to solve a problem, I guess, or continually wants to use it. And I find myself in that position. So thanks you for coming to my lectures, and I hope you've gained some little light in these lectures. Thank you. Oh, I meant to, not to, I'm sorry, I don't want to be ungracious. I should say I've been very helped by a number of people, I've had a lot of colleagues, helpful colleagues in this whole thing. And one is Jean Dambai, who's here. We've worked together closely. And Jim Vera. And Gerard Morant, who's from France, from Paris. He's also been involved in this work. And so it's... But the person who inspired me initially was Jerman Dahlquist. He actually taught me the connection between moments and quadrature. And, well, for many of us, he's a great inspiration. He's probably one of the leading figures in numerical analysis over the last 50 years. So I've been very fortunate in the colleagues I've chosen. So thank you.